Disclaimer. The views and opinions expressed by the participants in this show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show.
Hey.
And our guest today, the legendary, somebody we have been trying to have on for many years, since we started this show, really, the author of so many books, not only Hayao Miyazaki, Master of Japanese Animation, but she worked on the Anime Encyclopedia with Jonathan Clements, and actually won an Eisner Award, nominated for an Eisner Award for her book, The Art of Osamu Tezuka, God of Manga, won a Harvey Award for the Art of Osamu Tezuka, God of Manga. It's Helen McCarthy. Helen, thank you so much for coming on the program.
Oh, that's my pleasure. I'm just sorry it's taken us so long to get it together.
Yeah, well, you know, we tried and tried and tried, and this was the only time.
I'm a hard woman to track down.
That's very true. I'll just point out here as a programming note, it is midnight on Labor Day weekend. Justin and I... Justin and I are on the West
Worse
Coast.
For wear is the phrase I would use.
Worse for wear.
Have you had a good Labor Day weekend, though?
We both have, actually. It's been pretty
good. It's been a good time, but I actually just did a 3-hour hike today, so I'm just, I'm exhausted.
So if we get to Twitter time a little early, you'll know why. but we have been looking forward to having Helen on for so long. And so I guess I want to start out with, this is the boilerplate question. You started in the early 90s, so how'd you get into anime?
81. Well, actually late 80, but he's forgotten our first meeting. I met the guy I'm still with.
Okay.
And the fact that he's forgotten our first meeting and I'm still with him tells you what a bundle of awesomeness he is. But in 1981, I met my partner, Steve Kite. And Steve had just graduated from art college and just got back from a post-college trip with his buddies. You know, you go and kind of hang out and do crazy things in Europe. And they went to Spain. And Spain, of course, had had anime on TV and had had manga in translation for, I think, 3 or 4 years at that point. So they were in Spain and they saw Mazinger Z on a late night TV show. It was called Goldorak in Spain, I think. And blown away by it, because these were a bunch of illustration graduates who were kind of so plugged into the traditional Japanese aesthetic that the contemporary Japanese aesthetic of 81 really blew their minds. So they rushed out, went all over town, bought a ton of comics in Spanish and every toy they could lay their hands on. And Steve and I, when we got together, of course, I got the usual, you know, when you're dating, you go around to somebody's place, you look at their stuff. And he was still living with his parents, so I met his mum and dad. And when we went to his room, he said, look at this incredible, amazing stuff. It's Japanese. Now, like everybody else, I had the tea ceremony, samurai, wartime kamikaze image of Japan logged in my head. And like a lot of people in my generation, my dad had been in the forces during the Second World War, and he had a very negative image of Japan. So all my studies of Japan had been done in school and had been fairly restricted to medieval history. So when I saw this and I thought, and you know, it sounds stupid now, but back then we didn't think of modern Japan, contemporary Japan, as having its own graphic culture. And I just thought, wow, I've got to find out more about this. Now, the internet obviously existed in 81, but it was in its infancy. And I certainly didn't know that many people who were plugged into it, nobody at home. So I did what you always did back then. I went to the library to look for a book. And there were no books in English. Remember, this is 81. Not even Shōtsu Manga had come out then.
Right.
I think we were only 3 or 4 years past the first ever academic paper on manga, which was done at the University of Austin, as far as I know, in English. So I was furious. You know, there's no book. What's going on here? There has to be a book. So, of course, that meant I had to write a book because nobody else was doing it. And that led us on this amazing journey that we went on together, Steve and I. And here I am as a result.
Right. Okay. So how many times do you feel like you've told that story?
Never enough. Any writer will tell you there is no such thing as bad publicity. There is no such thing as repetitive publicity. I will tell that story with gratitude and delight every time someone asks me, to the day I die. Also, it's been so much fun. I mean, you know, when you look back on things in your life and you think, my God, if I hadn't taken that decision, hadn't taken that chance, hadn't opened that door, the things I would have missed if I hadn't just got interested in a go-and-a-guy robot and a guy. It just doesn't bear thinking about. My life would be completely different.
Sure, I was just being snarky.
snark away. This is kind of... You've been doing it for years, of course. You've trademarked it, but I heard somebody call that the Daryl Surratt tendency.
Okay.
He will be honored to hear that his name is carried so far.
Daryl and I go back a little way. Not as far as Steve and I, obviously, because Daryl wasn't born then, but a little way.
Right.
So what compelled you, I guess, you know, you had sort of an early interest in this stuff. Eventually you decided to turn it into a career. What about the material inspired you to do that? Like, obviously, you know, there was a lot in here that you hadn't seen before, but what made you think like, okay, I'm gonna pursue an entire academic and publishing career on this material? Like, what drove you to that?
Well, there are two things. Although it wasn't really a decision, it was kind of just something that happened. Because I was working, you know, very ordinary jobs, management jobs, and had never really... I've been writing since I was tiny, but I never really, really thought about publishing or doing anything like that. But two things drove me. The first thing was that the whole narrative structure of anime led me into manga. And that led me into Japanese contemporary culture, into all the fascinating stories that shoot off that. And then I started to see the wonderful connections that tie anime and manga to the rest of the world. I've never been interested in anime, manga, Japan as this exotic little thing that you put in a box and take out when you want to be entertained. It's a real living culture, and it's been part of world history. And, you know, we make a big thing of how different Japan is from us, but what drew me was how similar Japan is to us, how similar we all are at bottom as humans, and how even though we dress them up in these wonderful exotic ways, our narratives, our legends, our cultural history has so many wonderful links. I honestly do not understand how easy it is to drive wedges between nations when you look at how much we all have in common. So that was one thing. The more I explored this allegedly alien territory, the more I found things that I recognized. And gradually, as I went deeper into it, people that I recognized, people from British history, people from French and American history, in there, in Japan, either as missionaries in the late medieval, early Renaissance period, which is a passion of mine, or in the mid-1800s, late 1800s, as new immigrants rushing out to the wild east frontier to make money. There were lots of familiar faces there saying to me, you know, this is a fabulous, fabulous culture, but it's not alien, it's human, and you belong in it as much as you belong in any human culture anywhere on the planet. Just come and fit in and see what you can find out. And the other thing was the fabulous narrative spin that Japan puts on our common human experience. We all basically have the same experience, whatever our culture, whatever our area in history. We're born, we go through life, we fall in love, we conquer empires or whatever, we die. But the spin that Japan puts on that, the different angles that living in Japan and writing about Japan put on that, just fascinated me as a writer. And there are so many characters that come bursting out of the pages of Japanese history that I suppose are familiar to Japanese kids who go through school, but were unfamiliar to me and yet had these echoes of characters I knew. So once you actually give any writer a big new narrative playground, and we are just so in there. And the other thing was that nobody else was doing this stuff. People were doing stuff about things that had begun to appear in the West, and there was fantastic work. You know, gradually as we explored, we found out what was being done in America by people like Rob Fenelon and all the early popularizers of anime and manga. Fantastic work by Fred Patton, most amazing. Fred did the most fantastic writing, and you were so lucky to have his archive over there to explore. But a lot of work just wasn't being done. People were not asking questions like, who directed this? What's the style of this cinematographer? This character designer is doing interesting stuff. Where did that come from? How was he developed? So I wanted to kind of ask those questions because they were questions that occurred to me. And I thought, you know, I'm not that clever. If they're questions that are occurring to me, they must be occurring to other people. So let's go in there and find out. And that kind of led to Anime UK, which led to all sorts of other things.
You know, one of the things that struck me, what you said about how foreign Japan used to seem, that I think has been the biggest change in the time I've doing this, wouldn't you say?
Definitely.
People, especially the younger generations of fans, don't even regard Japan as even very different.
Well, of course, we've got much easier communication now. And once you communicate, people can actually begin to see how undifferent we all are, how many things about our lives are similar. But just the familiarity of vision, you know, just the fact that you can click on a live feed on your computer now and watch what's going on now in Akihabara or in, if you can find somebody feeding from Okinawa, in Okinawa. Although, to be honest, if I were in Okinawa, I'd just be on the beach. I wouldn't be even thinking about live feeds.
Right.
But you kind of get familiar. So you're quite right. It's that from this wonderful exotic thing. It's kind of like the moon, isn't it? You know, we were all so thrilled when Neil Armstrong, may he rest in peace, walked on the moon. And in a couple of years, it was like, the moon, yeah, ho-hum.
Yeah, I hear passing around a bunch of moon rocks. Yeah, they're rocks. Okay.
Yeah. They're rocks. They're from the moon. So what? We get used to things so quickly. It's one of our great strengths as animals that we adapt so fast. But it gets harder to maintain the sense of wonder. You have to be much more focused now to have a sense of wonder, I think.
Absolutely. We lose that so easily, especially with animation, because everything becomes so technically been there, done that so fast.
Yeah, what is this thing with technical stuff? I don't know. I always thought maybe I didn't get it because I'm not particularly a technical person, but why are people so hyped about the technique of anime?
I think it's, you know, something that you can just sort of latch on to that, you know, that it's fun. When we took the studio tours, you know, I was just like, hey, this is just Adobe After Effects. I know lots of people that can do this, but it's, you know, it's not that. It's, you know, the craft behind it. But, you know, it's easy to say, hey, I know After Effects. I can do that.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's always struck me as weird because if you take something like Gatchaman or, of course, Gundam, the first season of Gundam, the second season of Gundam, which I utterly adore. But if you look at those by contemporary standards, the animation creaks. But will you ever see stories as epic and engaging and involving as those? They just, every time I sit down and watch Gatchaman again, it blows me away.
I can't deal with Gatchaman, to be honest.
Well, fair enough. That's it. Everybody has their own series that blows them away.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right.
No, yeah, I get what you're saying.
It's very rarely about technique, is it?
And it's usually in our jumping on point, you know, whenever it's usually like one of the first few things we discovered that really like made that first impact.
Mm. Well, I know for me, the big thing, of course, has always been Tonari no Totoro. I saw Totoro for the first time on a fairly good, because I had a very good American supplier, Japanese only copy. And even though, I mean, I speak very little Japanese, kind of just enough to get by as a tourist, but then virtually none. I could do konnichiwa and that kind of thing, but that was it. But even with no Japanese, I could sit and watch it and follow the story. And I thought, I have to know where this comes from. I have to know about the person that could write this story, the person that could make this story. I was just awed by the depth and complexity and simplicity and the sheer balls of that story. Because, you know, how many directors can you think of off the top of your head who have had the guts to make a story about living with the threat of death from the point of view of a child at a child's eye level, at a child's pace? That really takes some doing.
I never thought about that before, but now I can say, man, the balls on Totoro.
Oh, yeah. Totoro balls are pretty epic, and I bet you they'll be serving them deep-fried in Osaka next week.
Yeah.
really. I mean, that was an insight that was given to me by a small girl at a presentation I did. London Children's Film Festival used to run cinema crit sessions for 4 and 5 and 6 year olds, for very small primary school children. I suppose you'd call them elementary school children. And I love working with very young kids because they're hard work and you have to be on your toes, but they give you a lot of insights. And I'd shown them Totoro and we were talking about the story and talking about character. And one of the things that you do when you're talking to very young kids is you have to strip it down to its simplest elements because you don't know how advanced any of them are going to be, not intellectually, but in terms of being able to verbalize their concepts. So we were talking about why different characters behaved in different ways and talking about, was there a bad guy in this story? And we came to the conclusion that there wasn't. You know, there are people who are a bit snarky. We've all got nasty little brothers. We've all got stupid sisters. I said, why do you think there's no bad guy in this story? This tiny little girl, tiny little girl who'd been very quiet, put her hand up and waited for me to go to her with the mic and said, they don't need a bad guy because the mummy is going to die. And that was a moment of revelation to me because she went straight to the heart of what counts about Totoro, that death is an inevitable part of nature in just that one sentence. And I love that. That is why I adore working with fiction and working with narrative and working with people about narrative.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's a really good story.
It's one of my favorites about the teaching I do. And I mean, I love to teach and I love to speak and I'd love to do more of it. I'm always looking for more teaching gigs. So anybody out there, I'm here. But the reason that I love to teach is that it's the best way I know to learn.
So over the years, so people kind of know you as an author and someone who's kind of, you know, turn this into sort of a career in terms of talking about this stuff. But are you still active? Do you keep watching new things? Do you keep up with it, or is it like
there's such a flood? You know, how do you keep up with everything? I don't know how you guys do it.
You have to have
minions to watch everything. I mean, I do keep up with a certain amount, but it tends to be very random. There are particular directors I'm fond of. There are particular people I follow. And then I dip in and out of new stuff and newish stuff. And I'm usually way behind the curve because there are so many fantastic old things that people aren't looking at, particularly in the early years of anime, that I find really interesting, that the new things tend to get pushed on the back burner a bit. I mean, all the fuss about Tiger and Bunny, I've only really recently gone through. But I just love watching narrative, any narrative. So I kind of dip in and out at random. And of course, at the moment, I'm constantly, ever since 1998, I've been constantly thinking about better watch something and make a few notes because, of course, there's the Anime Encyclopedia, which always demands updating. So I'm making notes in the hope that will keep needing more updates. I'm watching stuff that people kindly send me, which is quite wonderful. I have several very, very good friends who keep telling me what I should see and what I shouldn't see. And thank you, Darius. This is a shout out to you. But you know, it is impossible to keep up. I mean, if there is anybody out there who says they watch every piece of anime made now, they are lying. That's the end of the story.
Wow. You hear that, guys, in the forum?
Yeah.
We don't believe you.
Yeah, any one individual who says that they see every piece of anime currently made. You know, like, when do you go to the toilet?
Helen, don't ask questions you don't want to know the answers to.
You know, when do you shower? You can't take your smartphone into the shower, so I don't think I want to sit near you. I've had enough of that at conventions.
You're making an assumption that they shower.
Yeah, well, that is a dangerous assumption, as all of us who have hung out in late-night video rooms at cons know. And actually, that's one place that I do catch up with quite a lot of stuff. I go and lurk in late-night video rooms at conventions, and it's a very good place for catching up with things, I find.
So I guess that was sort of leading into my next question, which is, has there been anything recently that you've seen that inspired you to write anything that you saw that said really spoke to you and you felt like, okay, I got to write about this?
Not recently. The last thing that really, really gave me a buzz was Arrietty. And that's because it tied in so closely to the feel, the emotional feel of the original book, which was essentially about the death of the Edwardian era and class distinctions in that era. Mm. And that wonderful sense in it of a dying world, quite literally seen through the eyes of a dying child.
Wow.
And the whole colonialist thing, that really got me. But an awful lot of recent anime hasn't floated my boat. I thought Tiger and Bunny was very pretty and sweet and charming. I didn't find it all that exciting. When all the fuss about Red Line came down the line a couple of years ago, I thought, well, okay, let's see where we go with this. And it's about racing cars, for God's sake, guys.
Yeah, it's just
funny. Yes, it looks very nice, but we did this kind of thing in Speed Racer.
Yeah, it's just eye candy. It's not.
It's somebody said to me, I really thought Red Line was going to change the world. And I thought, oh my God, you are so sweet and so innocent and so, so very, very deluded. people always hope for the next big thing in anime. And to be honest, we're probably not going to notice the next big thing in anime because you two and I are going to be too busy trying to write everything down quickly and document it and keep up. And everybody else isn't going to start saying it's the next big thing until the momentum builds. So I don't know. I mean, I follow studios. I love Production IG. I absolutely adore Production IG because they have class. And a Studio 40C is, oh, they have such balls. And I love Madhouse. I have, you know, the British 90s fan affection for Madhouse because they did some stuff that came over to us in the early days of British anime, which was a big thing, bigger than American anime in the 90s. And, you know, I mean, how can you not love the people that gave you Wicked City? It is really, really hard not to warm to an organization that's given Yoshiaki Kawajiri gainful employment for so long. But, you know, it's Ghibli, of course, is worth following, particularly now because Ghibli keeps reinventing itself. Toshio Suzuki is a magician and he keeps pulling rabbits out of that hat of what's going to happen to Ghibli, and he keeps us all engaged and interested and chatting and wondering and hopefully making good movies.
What do you think about this whole Gorō Miyazaki thing? Because, you know, honestly, I don't know anybody that really liked Earthsea.
Well, apparently an awful lot of teenagers in Japan really liked Earthsea, which is quite interesting, I think. But then that comes down to someday I've got a pile of notes and someday I'm going to write up the timeline of Earthsea from the point at which Ursula Le Guin signed the papers and saw Miyazaki in August to the point at which the movie came out and began to make money. Because if you actually look at that timeline, it reads, you can read it as a magnificent, brilliant piece of media manipulation on a level with any political dark arts master's finest work. And we've got some political dark arts masters in Britain, so I've had the opportunity to study really great media manipulators up close and personal. And I think that if you look at the dates of that timeline and the way Gorō Miyazaki's blog and leaked comments about what Hayao allegedly said come out, I think you see an absolutely brilliant campaign building. Now, I'm not saying that was intentional, but if it was, it was bloody clever. and I mean, when you look at Gorō, I mean, I'd be honest, if somebody came up to you and said, hey, I know that you have never actually worked in film in your life, and I know that you've just been running your dad's museum for the past couple of years, but here's the greatest studio in the world. I'm going to give it to you to direct a movie. What do you say? I mean, how many of us would say no thanks? And for Gorō, it must have been really difficult because, of course, Toshio Suzuki has been a friend of both his mom and his dad for so many years. And if you're, you know, a Japanese guy, even a Japanese guy of, I think he was almost 40, wasn't he, when he directed Earthsea? it's very difficult to turn down an old family friend when they say to you, I want you to do this job for me. So I can understand why Goro did it. And I can understand why, in my opinion, he didn't do it particularly well, because if somebody said to me, hey, come and direct the New York film because I liked your dad, you know, I wouldn't do a particularly good job.
Right.
But what I find most impressive about Earthsea is that even though it wasn't a very good film, it did so well at the box office. It didn't out-earn, as far as I know, the big Ghibli earners even yet, and I haven't checked on it this year. But it did earn back all its money in people paying box office tickets, and that's always been one of Ghibli's proudest achievements, that they make their profits from bums on seats, not from merchandising. Merchandising is just a cherry on the cake. So maybe I'm wrong. Maybe Goro isn't such a disaster for the studio. And certainly when you see Up on Poppy Hill, that seems to have gone really, really well. I know a huge number of people who like it better than Arrietty.
Have you seen it yet?
Yes, and I don't like it better than Arrietty.
Oh.
Although it's a very pretty film, and I do like it better than Howl.
Yay.
Yeah. I don't know. I part of me kind of thinks that with the whole Ghibli thing, like, it's kind of like Pixar, where we're past their golden age, and now they're figuring out what it is they're going to do with themselves.
Mm.
And it's very similar to Pixar in terms of, you know, the people at the top of this thing. In Miyazaki's case, he's aging out of the business. Like, he always says he's going to retire, but he's getting to the point where...
Yeah, but you've been saying that since he was 50.
Sure, but...
He's aging out of the business. He's 67.
Okay.
Kurosawa was still preparing films at 80, and if he hadn't died, he would have made more. Clint Eastwood, God knows we should never let him near a political platform, yeah, but he's still a hell of a director, and he's still directing films. So we could have, theoretically, another 10 to 15 years of Miyazaki at work. Takahata,
really?
I think, we'll be very lucky to see another Takahata film. Because,
yes,
remember, he's
would.
5 years Miyazaki senior.
And that breaks my heart, because Takahata's always been by far my favorite of the two.
Takahata makes better movies.
Takahata is a really interesting director, because he's actually much more sardonic and much darker, but also much more romantic in many ways than Miyazaki. But I think that Takahata just does what he wants to do, which is why he's so great, but also why he is, I mean, Miyazaki calls him the sloth. He if he only worked faster, he would be the perfect movie director. I think we'll be very lucky to see the film he's supposed to be working on finished. But I would love to see another Takahata. That would be fantastic. That would be such a gift. But when he goes, they've got Yonebayashi lined up now, and maybe they'll let him make a Yonebayashi movie rather than a Ghibli movie next time.
That'd be nice.
They've got. Sorry, go on.
I just said that would be nice.
Well, yeah, because I think he's got some great movies in him. But I think no director can really work in the mold created by another. You've got to break and make your own style within that mold. And if he may not be able to do that till Miyazaki dies, because, you know, he owes so much to Miyazaki, and he reveres him so much that maybe he will need that thread to break before he can take that step.
Mm.
You know, you were talking about Arrietty a little earlier, and my feelings on that film are a little mixed. Like, I saw it, and I was like, meh. And Justin, I feel like you liked it maybe a little bit more than I did.
I liked it enough to buy it, and I'll probably revisit it once every couple of years, but I don't think I'll... it's definitely not one of my favorite Ghibli films.
But here's the thing, though. Like, I didn't see any larger themes in that. But Helen, you were just talking about something very compelling, I thought, in terms of larger themes in that film. If you could just elaborate that on that a little bit, I would love to hear about that, because I watched that and I was like, this is a nice sort of a family film, but it's a take on The Borrowers, and we've all seen The Borrowers a million times. But you were talking about a thematic take on it that I would like you to get into that a little bit more.
Well, I actually blogged on it because I got so excited about it, and I don't blog on that many films at length and in detail. But if you go back to The Borrowers and Mary Norton, The Borrowers is written at a time of enormous tension. I mean, Mary Norton was evacuated with her children to America during the Second World War because she came from quite a well-to-do family and she'd married quite well. And like many, you know, well-to-do Brits, the US and Canada were relatively safe places. Europe certainly wasn't a great place to evacuate to, and Australia was still a bit too far. But you guys gave sanctuary to a lot of people during those years, for which we'll always be grateful. But there she was, parted from her husband, whom she adored, who, of course, like most people, was doing war work, and so you never knew what was going to happen, with her own children, reflecting on her own childhood, which had also come at a time of enormous upheaval. She'd grown up as the daughter of a well-to-do family in a small town in Britain, which was probably one of the most blessed places on earth to be in the teens and 20s of the 20th century. She'd had an idyllic life with all the social and cultural amenities of a little town on her doorstep, but with masses of countryside, fields to roam in, brothers to play with, friends to play with. She'd had a fabulous, fabulous, well-to-do childhood. And because social barriers in her day were still quite extreme, she hadn't actually mixed, except in terms of doing charitable work at church as she got older, with any of the lower orders, unless they happened to be servants or tradespeople. So she brought all that to writing The Borrowers, and she was writing at a time of the most enormous social change, because obviously the war broke down so many barriers. It had to, because so many people died. And my parents would literally never have met, even though they grew up in the same small town, not more than a mile and a half apart. They would never have met but for the war, because my mother was Catholic and my father was Protestant, and you simply didn't. You didn't socialize. And Norton was in the same position. So she was writing about the crumbling of these huge social barriers and the fear of crumbling of these huge social barriers. And what I see very strongly in Arrietty is the same theme you see in quite a lot of Hammer films, in quite a lot of Penny Dreadful novels of the late Victorian era, the early modern era. The servant girl despoiled by the guy from the big house. Now, in this instance, the big house really is the big, big house, and the servant girl can't possibly physically be despoiled by the guy from the big house. But still, she's being shown a world that she has never imagined, and he's looking into a world that he's never imagined. And you've got that appalling and wonderful moment when the barriers of society may crumble because two people look at each other and say, "Why can't we be together?" And all the things that people fight about around that. And then, of course, you've also got death, which Shibley does very, very well, which is the ultimate why can't we be together answer. You know, we can't be because I might not be here tomorrow. And then you've also got the child's eye romantic view of deprivation. I mean, when you're a little kid, it looks like real fun to make houses out of cigar boxes and to put meals on the table made of, you know, I don't know if guys do actually, they used to. I don't know if they do now, but pulling together bits of flower heads and arranging them on a leaf and saying, there, that's dinner, and having tea parties for your action men and your dolls and your Godzillas, as Steve and I still do.
I did that last night, but yeah, anyway, go on.
I believe Eric Cartman does that.
That's it, but kids do that, and they don't see it as the appalling thing that many, many people have to do to survive. And so many parents, like the parents in Arrietty, kind of strive to shield their children from the terrible fact that if you can't scrounge a lump of sugar from somewhere, you're out of food. So it's a movie, I think, with a lot in it about the present day, so artfully and beautifully and tricksily disguised that it's actually easy to avoid that. But The Borrowers was a deeply subversive book, which is one reason why it's lasted. Subversive books always last. Wow. And successive media riffs on it have tried to rip out its teeth and make it support the status quo. But The Borrowers is still a deeply subversive book. And for me, Arrietty was a deeply subversive movie, and that, I think, is wonderful. I want to show kids, especially little girls, I want to show them subversive movies, because that way they'll grow up to be subversive people, and that, in my humble opinion, is a wonderful thing.
Damn.
I have to rewatch that movie now.
Yeah, I was going to say, I got to watch that shit again, man.
Well, go back and have a look on my blog, either before or after, and see if you agree with the comments there. I mean, I have a terrible tendency. Somebody once said to me, you know, you would be a really great critic if you weren't so feminist. And I do have a terrible tendency to see everything from the only perspective I have, which is as a 20th century white Western woman. That's my perspective. But I think that it's reasonable to read the fruits of popular culture as political and social documents, because they are mostly aimed at putting us into particular political and social corrals. And when you see something that breaks out of that a little bit and challenges it, it's fun.
Hey, look, I get thrown into the fire all the time for being too liberal. By listeners of the show, people in
you mean you believe in people eating and being able to go to hospital when they're sick? Shame on you.
Believe it or not, but I do get that shit. So, like, the fact that anyone would tell you that, like, oh, your take on, oh, you're too feminist, like, fuck those people. Like,
what did they say about Amy Talbin?
No, really, I mean, how guys don't, you know, this really gets me at cons. Sometimes I hear young guys mouthing off and I want to take them into a corner and put my arm around them and say, listen, do you realize that you have just wiped your chance of getting laid with everybody within earshot?
Oh, Helen, they never had a chance of getting laid.
Oh, but everybody's got a chance of getting laid. Really? I mean, I know, a God, when I think of some of the adventures I had when I was young, I kind of think I'm glad I didn't keep photographs of those guys. But, you know, literally, I mean, how hard is it to get laid? Everybody.
It's not that hard. I'm living proof.
But yeah, at conventions, you do sometimes fear for the survival of the human race, don't you?
Sometimes, yes.
Yeah, sure. Some conventions more than others.
Well, unfortunately, I mean, most people do grow out of it, or find partners who are sympathetic and supportive. And I mean, I was very lucky. I met someone who helped me become the person that I could not possibly have been on my own, and that's what you always hope for. But honestly, yeah, sometimes.
So here's my big question. This is what I really want to know. I know you're a huge fan of Studio Ghibli, and I want to know your least favorite Miyazaki film and your least favorite overall Ghibli film.
My least favorite overall Ghibli is Earthsea, without a doubt.
Right. Okay.
It is, in my view, it's just... It's sloppy, it has plot holes, it's a total betrayal of the original book, which I adore. And, you know, it doesn't help, does it, when you absolutely love a book and somebody makes a film that demolishes it totally and betrays everything the book stands for.
Yeah.
So Earthsea, you know, not a good movie to take me to, really, because I'll be chewing the screen and I'll be ranting so much I'll get us thrown out of the theatre. But my least favourite Miyazaki... It's probably Howl.
Yeah, that's not I don't think that's difficult to pick. Howl.
Again, maybe because I adore the book.
Oh, right.
I mean, the late Diana Wynne Jones, God bless her, fabulous, fabulous writer, and she did so much work beyond Howl that if any of you listeners haven't checked out her work, they should get onto Amazon and check it out as soon as possible, because she is a really great writer. And her Howl is obviously a different take on the Miyazaki Howl, but I think that the issues that I have around it are that it is, of all the Ghibli movies, I think, the most deeply conventional. Hmm. And also the most deeply expressive of what I think is Miyazaki's inbuilt belief, which is that women have infinite potential, and that infinite potential is best worked out while they're young, so that then they can settle down and be good wives and mothers.
Wow.
Well, he's, I mean, I was lucky enough to meet him as a person, and he impressed me very much. And I think that a lot of the work he does with female characters is quite marvelous. But I've never understood this big thing about Miyazaki as a feminist, because if you look at the women in Miyazaki movies, all the ones who don't end up becoming good, happy, fulfilled wives and mothers usually end up in a fairly bad place. Look at Kashana.
Man, give me a lot to think about here.
Hayao Miyazaki, the anti-feminist, yeah.
Well, is that a surprise, though, that... Miyazaki's been known... He keeps writing these quote-unquote strong female characters, usually his heroines are female. That's redundant. Usually his heroes are female. And he has a tendency to write strong female characters that are in the hero position. Everyone else in the story typically sort of conforms to its sort of Japanese sensibility and an old Japanese sensibility of what a woman's place is.
The idea that women are wonderful, marvelous, heroic, full of personality, full of energy, but that this has to be slotted into a specific place in society is something that you know, we find Miyazaki's generation, obviously, of Japanese guys, and I suppose later generations too, up till quite recently, would find that quite acceptable. We find it unacceptable. On the other hand, I mean, the thing that I always have to say to myself, looking at this kind of idea, and as a feminist, I was brought up a feminist. I was brought up to believe that women are absolutely equal and own the universe, to the extent where it never even occurred to question it till I got to university and found that people weren't. I do ask myself, is maybe what Miyazaki's saying better for society as we currently have it structured? Because if you look at relative rates of social breakdown, relative rates of child delinquency, relative rates of poor educational outcome, they tend to be lower in so-called developed societies where women are more engaged with the upbringing of their children than in societies where women are more focused on their own achievement. And I haven't really done an awful lot of work on that. I've only read on it very superficially, but it's an impression that you get right across the world, except in Scandinavia, where they structure their whole society and pay a great deal of money to be much more male-female equal. So I think, you know, maybe, although I don't like what Miyazaki's saying, maybe it's a good thing he's saying it, because he keeps presenting us with this idea that we then have to consider.
Man, I gotta go back and watch all this stuff again. I don't know about you, Justin, but this is giving me a whole perspective on Miyazaki's, and frankly, the entire Ghibli line of work, where it's like, I gotta go back and look at all this stuff.
Well, the Miyazaki's feminist stuff, I think, yeah, I mean, that's been discussed a bit, but no amount of new data will make me sit through Howl's again.
That is true.
It's so sad, because Howl is his only Bishonen. And we ought to, well, all of us ladies ought to be happy about that, but it's just very difficult.
Well, if it wasn't such a shitty movie, you know, that would be better. But it is a shitty movie. Like, it turns into a different movie halfway through.
And if you think about it visually, Hal looks much more like Earthsea than it looks like, say, Porco Rosso or even Spirited Away. Hal's colors are very oversaturated.
Yeah.
And well, some of his drawing is very, very almost messy, you know, almost jammy line. You know when you used to get those old toy cells and you used to go through them? Most of them were beautiful, but every now and then you get ones with really thick lines that had been scribbled a bit or the paint had wandered. Like that.
Well, it was it was post-digital conversion. I think that might play a large part of it.
It could do, but you know, again, I think this is an old guard, new guard thing. Miyazaki would not have permitted frames to go out with messy line work on his pre-computer era stuff. Mm. I don't know how they persuaded him to let them go out with messy line work on Howl and to an extent on Spirited Away, which they do. So, you know, maybe it's not all post-digital. Maybe the shift is happening in the head as much as it's happening in the technology.
Or it could be, you know, he's just not drawing every third cell like he used to.
Yeah, that could be. And he's not exerting the demonic levels of control that he previously used to.
He used to basically correct or draw every frame of that film himself. Can't do that in your 60s.
Mm. Well, also, you can't do that with the amount of other stuff he's having to do. Because if you think back, like, 10, 12 years, getting Miyazaki to a film festival outside Japan was really rare. Getting him to a film festival inside Japan was rare enough. And getting an interview with Miyazaki, when I was offered an interview with Miyazaki, I practically fell off my seat because I just couldn't believe it. He used to be very, very hard to get hold of because all his time was devoted to work. But, of course, with the Disney deal, it became more important for him to be visible and doing promotion. And so a lot of the time that he used to spend on correcting everybody's work, he now has to spend sitting on planes and talking to journalists.
Mm.
Yeah.
Still, we ruined him.
Still never. that is the number one question that I get asked, like, oh, which interview would you want? And everyone always says, like, oh, Miyazaki. And I'm like, nope, would not want that. Like, don't want to interview him. Have nothing to say to that guy. Like, let him finish out his career.
Well, it was a great interview, and I really enjoyed it. But I think I was lucky to do it when I did in 97, 98, in the final phases of Mononoke.
Oh, yeah. Well, that would have been a good time, yeah.
Yeah, and I was lucky enough to do it at his private office at Bataya, not at Ghibli. So I got him in the environment that he designed himself and that he felt for himself and that he felt most comfortable in. And it was just a fabulous, you know, one of the afternoons that I'm sure I will remember right at the end of my life as one of the best times I've ever had. But it wouldn't obviously be the same experience today because it would have two or three of his people alongside and it would take about 10 minutes and I'd be very lucky to get that. But no, I think now the people that would be most interesting to interview now are either people at the very, very end of long lives in anime, like Yasuo Otsuka, whom I've always thought, you know, I think that guy is just amazing, or Takahata, or people just starting out in the industry. You may have seen about 5 years ago, there were a series of interviews of young people who'd begun to work in the industry and either had to drop out or were on the verge of dropping out because they couldn't afford to live on the money. And that was quite fascinating.
I haven't read those specifically, but I've heard many accounts and it's just heartbreaking.
Mm. I mean, honestly, would you want your 21-year-old graduate daughter to live in a two-tatami room with cold water and eat pot ramen all the time just so she could work in animation with a bunch of spotty, unwashed guys? No parent would want that.
Forget the parent. Nobody wants that for themselves.
It's funny how many people do as a means to an end. You know, I talk to so many people. I've done some work with a British college recently. And so many of the people there are desperate to work in either games or anime. And I say to them, you know, games, yeah, go for it. You've got the chance of making really good money. You'll have a more civilized corporate structure. You'll actually get an employed job rather than having to do contract work. Anime, forget it. But people want it desperately. People want it and dream about it. And I think we kind of, nowadays, we tend to forget that people very often want what's hard to have. Hmm. And besides, you know, most of us spent most of our student years sleeping on the floor and eating pot noodles, didn't we? So,
right, that's true.
So what's different? You just do it for a few more years for virtually no money.
Sure. Right. And sleeping on the floor, eating noodles, playing video games and watching anime. So maybe that's where that comes from.
That's it. It's everyone's idea of the ideal life. It's just not what you imagine yourself doing professionally.
Sure, right.
We're really lucky because we still get to do that.
Yeah, right. See, I get paid and I do that anyway, so...
Yeah.
So, the other thing I want to talk to you about before we get to Twitter, and I feel like we could go all night here, but you were at the center of a little bit of a controversy a couple of years ago when you were had the balls, as it were, to actually complain about your shit getting stolen.
Yeah, and, I still do.
And I admire that. And I'm curious what that was like for you, and if you could recap that, and maybe talk about what that was like for you, and what kind of mail you got.
Well, it gets me very angry. It still gets me very angry. And I'm actually talking to a few people about a way of possibly dealing with that. But I won't say too much about that because it's still in the early stage. It gets me angry because people don't seem to realize that their work is all that a creative artist has. You know, we don't get pension plans. We don't get holiday pay. We don't get sick pay. Our work is all we have. And if you steal my work and give it away to other people without my permission, you are quite literally depriving me of the opportunity of sales. And I know a lot of people, very, very talented people, who live on the margin of viability, despite creating work that many, many people enjoy and love, because they're robbed. Now, that's wrong. That's exploitation. And a lot of people who talk about, you know, oh, well, creatives have to put their work out there and just trust that people will give them something. Like, that's slavery. You have to work for me. And if I think your work is worth it, I might give you a crust now and then, or I might not. William Wilberforce worked against that in Britain in the 1800s. You know, we just don't have that. And it is completely unfair to creative people. Now, I can see where people are coming from, because once TV started and it began to be perceived that entertainment was free, because we don't think about all the hidden costs associated with TV, they're embedded in society, it was more or less inevitable that people would start to ask why other forms of entertainment weren't free. And we live in a society where we all believe that something happens for nothing, even though we all know practically that we wouldn't work for nothing. Therefore, why should we expect other people to work for nothing? We still think, you know, cheap clothes are right, cheap foods are right, to hell with kids exploited in India and China sewing them, to hell with battery chickens. We're entitled to have Chick-fil-A every night if we want it. So we have that huge sense of entitlement embedded in our society. I've got to say, it's not just America's fault. People blame you guys for this, but it's not just America's fault. It's the developed world as a whole. And that sense of entitlement is what drives people to believe that if they happen to want, let's say, 25 manga a week, and they only have the money for 3 manga a week, it's perfectly okay to go to a site where they're available and download them for free. And it's not. But, I mean, for me, what it was like, well, I hate to say this because it's going to sound awful, but it was fun. It was so much fun. Because I love opinions. If I don't agree with them, I don't agree with them and I say I don't like them. But I love anything that gets people fired up enough to put themselves on the line and care. And actually, that's the one thing that pisses me off, that so many people don't do this under their real names. I mean, hey, come on, guys. If you're ashamed of an opinion, shut the fuck up. Don't just call yourself Nightwing Starfinder and put it out there and feel brave. If you don't stand up and put your own name to something, you're not brave, you're a wuss. But I love opinions. I love a good fight. And that was, it was so much fun. And it challenged me every step of the way. It challenged me to think about what I was saying. It challenged me to think about, why do I hold these beliefs? Am I wrong? You know, would it be right that artists should be maintained in some other way and everybody should be entitled to take their stuff? And that, yeah, it was a lot of fun. Every now and then, I think I must do something like that again, because that's the subject that provokes most stuff. Well, actually, it's not the subject that's provoked most hits on my blog, but that is the subject that you can generally rely on to get a lot of people involved in fighting. And yeah, maybe it'd be fun to do that again. I like a good fight. It keeps the blood flowing. You know, it's exercise in every sense of the word.
Yeah, I wish I could agree with you about the like.
Well, you guys must get so much more of it, though, because, I mean, you have a much higher public profile than I do, and you stick your heads above the parapet all the time. But I don't know. It's just combat is life, you know. Xena Warrior Princess, you better be focused. Got to be there. And you really do live in the moment with something like that. Because you're reacting to it all the time. The only thing that was maybe a bit negative about it is that it took my brain off every other form of work while it was at its most intense. And it's very, I mean, any kind of really combative stuff is quite destructive to decent poetry, which is something that I love to do. But, you know, nobody maintains that level of combat for long, except you guys who have so many people piling into you. So every now and then it's a good workout.
I don't know. I mean, I know Justin probably doesn't agree with you, but actually I think I know he doesn't agree with you on the whole...
I'm a pacifist.
Yeah, no.
Well, I'm a pacifist. I'm just a pacifist who believes that every now and then people need a good sock to the jaw.
Yeah, I think you're right.
There's a quotable.
I think you're right. I totally agree with that. Like, at some point, like, when do we decide that, like, creating entertainment isn't the industry that it's okay to just steal from? It's like the only product you can make where everyone agrees it's okay to take it for free.
Yeah.
I think there is something deeper at work there. I really do. I think there is an underlying suspicion. I'm not sure if jealousy is the right word, but definitely
envy,
frustration with people who get to work their lives doing something they genuinely love, and that everyone else fancies themselves doing.
Everybody can do that. I know. I mean, really, I'm sorry. Stop there.
Everyone can, but most don't.
If you want to do something you genuinely love, you do it. Everybody is an artist. Maybe we don't all make our living as an artist. Maybe, like me, with my teaching and my bits and pieces, and every now and then I do consultancy work, and I do various things. But maybe you don't make 100% of your money as an artist or a writer or an embroiderer or a rocket scientist or whatever. But that's what you are. And then you get a day job. And everybody, I mean, please, 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 everybody out there listening to this, you are an artist of some kind. You are a creative person. You were born that way. All kids are creative. Do not allow life to beat it out of you for the sake of 3 squares a day and a regular paycheck. You owe it to yourself to carry on being an artist, even if you need the regular paycheck to live. You know, everybody's got responsibilities. People have kids. People have cats. People have, you know, all sorts of things that they have to do. But you're an artist. And because we are all artists, we shouldn't ever envy the art in others. Because your art, whoever you are, wherever you are, your art is unique. And if you put that into the world, you will cease to envy. Because you'll be doing the thing that you evolved to do. You'll be creating. We all evolved to create life. And we all create life in different forms. And those of us who don't, that turns sour and nasty and goes into envy and war and all that cracked stuff that we have to deal with in society. Get back to creation. There ends the lesson, children.
It's hard to wrap my head around what a positive person she is, you know?
You know?
I mean, come on, what have I not got to be positive about? I do stuff I love. I get to slap people around if they don't, if they steal my stuff. I get to talk to great people for fun, you know? And I can still get by. It's... What's not to be positive?
I've learned something tonight.
That I will never be as positive as Helen McCarthy.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
It's weird, though, because, I mean, we live in a world of such massive inequality that I honestly don't know how anybody who lives in the developed nations and isn't searching dumpsters for their food can feel sorry for themselves. I mean, having said that, I've got friends who are and family who are facing awful medical outcomes. And I mean, most of us know somebody who's got something that is just so shitty and unfair that you want to strangle the universe. But leaving that aside, and we all draw different cards in the physical lottery, if you're not searching a dumpster for your food and you have somewhere to sleep, you've got nothing to complain about.
No, but I mean, your argument kind of boils down to a basic thing that I actually really appreciate, which is, and it's not so much of this, it's not so much a negative argument as it is, you know, look, you're envious or whatever, you want to create, you're frustrated that you can't create or you won't, or something in you is stopping you from doing it. Great. If you can't do it or don't want to do it or decide that, you know, you don't really have it in you, stop taking it from the people who actually do it under some weird pretense that you could do it if you wanted to. Like, actually look inside yourself and say, hey, could I create entertainment? And if the answer is no, then go ahead and pay the people who are entertaining you because it's bringing joy into your life. So you're paying for a product that you actually do enjoy. Anyway, it seems like that's kind of the long and short of it. Like, stop hating the people that make the shit that you actually really enjoy and brings joy into your life. I don't know.
I think that's kind of what Justin was saying, and I think that sums it up really well. And it does make me sad when people say I'm not creative, because everybody was born creative. We have in Britain, we have one of the most expensive education systems in the world. I think yours in the States is not far behind. And that education system does its utmost, despite the best efforts of great teachers, to spend 11 years beating the creativity out of every child that enters it.
Hey, I have to ask if you've been given pitches at anime conventions when you speak.
Oh, yeah. People come up to me and say, I really want to write a book with you. And I always listen, because you always hope. I mean, some of the best experiences in my life, both fanish and professional, have been collaborations. My favorite collaboration of all time is still a fanfic project I wrote with my best girlfriend many, many years ago. That was great. I mean, that bonded us, and we did a good job. And working with Jonathan Clements, utterly fantastic. Writing chapters for a number of books that I've done, great experience. But the problem is, a lot of people who come to me come with my skill set, and usually, all modesty apart, not on my level. And why would I want to work with a mini-me? You know, what I want in somebody to collaborate with, what I want to see in a pitch, is I want to see something that makes me go, shit, I wish I could do that. Wow, that is fantastic. Where did that come out of? I'm always looking. I mean, when people bring me pitches about books or say, how can I take this book forward? And I do a little bit of book doctoring. I talk to people and help them frame their proposals and so on for publication. And I'm always looking to be blown away by something original. And very often when I say to somebody, look, you've got the kernel of a fantastic book here. I think that what you're actually saying is you want to do this and this and this, but you've wrapped it up in this and this and this because you think that's better for the market. Why? It's usually because they're a little bit too scared to go out there on a limb. And I understand that, and maybe they're sensible, because God knows I've spent enough years getting turned down on insane proposals. But the thing is, if you really want to write a certain book, it's better to write that book and get it turned down. It's better to do that picture or that comic and get it turned down than it is to do some half-assed version of it that you'll never then be, or you may never be able to do the version you want, because people will say, well, you did that like 5 years ago and I don't want to go back there. So what I'm always looking for with pitches or with offers to work with me or offers of collaboration is I'm looking for something that blows me away. I'm looking for that moment that makes people download anime manga. I'm looking for that wow factor that, oh, I love that. I want that so much. How can I help you to get that into the public domain? And you know, so many people have that and they don't trust it.
Yeah. All right. Okay, so we should absolutely get to Twitter here.
Yes, we're an hour
in. It's way past your bedtime, isn't it?
Oh, no. Well, this has been fascinating, but...
I wish we could go on all night.
We got a Twitter... We got a lot
Another time.
We got a lot of Twitter questions here.
Have to have you back on soon.
Okay. Invalid Name asks, you tweet a lot of haiku. Could you talk about what it is you like about them?
Oh, haiku are a wonderful door into Japanese history and Japanese thought. I've been reading haiku since I was about 11 years old. And I've written poetry from a very, very early age. You know, most kids make up little verses, don't they? And they teach you things like spelling and multiplication tables through doggerel in school. And I can still sing the songs that I learned to teach me the Ten Commandments and the Catholic Catechism, although I won't expose you to that now. But
thank you.
The thing that I love with haiku is that, like all good poetic forms, it has a body of work on discipline and on strict form. But it also has a body of work and critical thinking and writing that says it's okay to throw that out the window and just make something using this form, bend it out of shape, hammer it. Haiku is an enormously robust poetic form. Leaving aside all the debate, which I won't go into now, about whether 575 or 353 or even 232, and 232 is a tough one. Two syllables, three syllables, two syllables. There are a lot of haikuists who think that because Japanese syllabaries pack so much meaning into each particular character, we should use much shorter forms for writing haiku in English or French or other forms. But the discipline of haiku fascinates me, and the fact that once you learn to inhabit that discipline, you can bend it out of shape and twist it around like wrought iron and make it into something fantastic. And the humour. I mean, there are so many funny haikuists out there, and not just in English, in all kinds of great languages. There's a wonderful guy. I belong and occasionally lurk on a forum called the Asahi International Haikuist Network, where there's a guy who writes haiku in Scots, which then have to be translated both into English and into Japanese. And, you know, how can you not love a poetic form that does that? But the other thing is, I think haiku are the mobile phone snapshot of poetry. You know, you go onto TwitPic or Tumblr or whatever, and you see 17,000 shots, and they're all, you know, yeah, okay. I don't know those people. That guy doesn't have a head. But okay. And one of them will stop you in your tracks and make you go, wow, I never saw that in that way before. Well, haiku are like that. At their best, they inject a thought into your brain, into your soul, that you never had in just that way before. And so I'm always looking to be open to that moment. And it's actually really good for mindfulness and for meditation, because once you start to write haiku seriously, and I tweet a haiku every day, and I write haiku almost every day, once you start to be that mindful, you become much more aware of the world around you. So haiku for me are a Zen discipline, they're a meditation discipline, they're a playground, they're just great fun.
Okay, well, now I know that the word haikuist exists. Mm-hmm. Be sure to use that in the future.
Or haiku practitioner, apparently, if you're being very posh. But I like haikuists.
Practitioner, I like that. Okay. Vicious Smith asks, why did you decide to write the erotic anime movie guide?
Because nobody else was doing it. That's why I've done most things in my life.
Okay.
No, I mean, wind back to Britain in the 1990s. Anime burst on the scene with Akira. But because of the way Manga Entertainment, who were then a British company, wanted to position anime in the marketplace, they were looking for material that would appeal to 12 to 17-year-old boys and college-age people. And they tended to think that that meant sex and violence. So they brought in an awful lot of anime. Some of it was not necessarily particularly violent. There was a wonderful technique called 15ing that evolved in that era, which meant essentially taking a fairly innocuous script and inserting as many cuss words as you could into it to achieve a higher rating from our censorship system. Because, of course, everybody knows that no self-respecting 12-year-old will watch a movie graded for 12-year-olds. They all want to watch 15s, and so it goes. But, I mean, the thing that struck me was, even from the little bit of research I'd done then in anime, I knew that there was a lot more to anime about sex than what we were getting in Britain. And there was a lot more to anime eroticism than what we were getting in Britain. And so look, I happened at the time to be working with Jonathan Clements, who'd come on board with Anime UK at a fairly early stage. And we thought that we could go into this, because Jonathan was even then an excellent linguist. Now he's a superb linguist. But we thought that we could look into this and look at some of the material that wasn't widely known and put a new picture of anime erotic out there. And also, being strictly practical, we knew that as writers, this would position us in areas where we wouldn't necessarily get publicity and sales otherwise. Men's magazines like Fiesta and Razzle in Britain reviewed a book about anime criticism. That doesn't happen every day of the week. So it was both a very hard-headed marketing decision. In fact, when we pitched it to my publishers, we started the pitch with, sex always sells. And I think the editor was sold at that point. So it was hard-headed marketing, but also it was a serious research decision.
How much absolutely unwatchable hentai did you have to sit through to make that book, though?
Oh, so many. So many. I mean, the gigolo. Watched more entertaining paint dry than watching the gigolo.
God, that's a bad OVA.
Yeah, Madball 34. I mean, how can you? Just how can you?
Well, with the 15 to dub, that's pretty funny.
Well, yeah, if you turn off your critical faculties completely and watch it with an awful lot of beer.
Right.
But, you know, one of Jonathan's and my slogans has always been, we watch this crap so you don't have to.
All right.
And it's true. Ted Sturgeon, Sturgeon's revelation applies. 90% of everything is crud.
Yeah.
And you only have to turn on the TV to prove that any day of the week.
Sometimes I think that number is a little low.
Well, yeah, I think we're working on raising it. But Sturgeon was a conservative estimator, and that's always a good thing when it comes to statistics, I think. So, yeah, it's there's a lot of bad anime out there, and somebody's got to warn the public.
Mm.
All right. Zeruda asks, planning a new edition of the Anime Encyclopedia anytime soon?
Watch the Stonebridge Press website is all I will say to that. Hi Daniel, hi Zeruda. Keep an eye on the website, and I'm sure there will be an announcement in due course.
Okay. Chuo Dori asks, your house is on fire and you only have time to save one manga or non-manga book. Which one would it be?
Oh, if I only have time to save one book... the book that I would save is a book that I saved for years to buy for myself and have never regretted for a second. A book called Queen Elizabeth's Wardrobe Unlocked by the great Janet Arnold, who is the god of costume. One of the other things that I've always been interested in is the history of dress and the history of costume, which is what led me into cosplay and masquerade in the first place. And Janet wrote this wonderful book about the account books of Queen Elizabeth I's wardrobe, which is the most astonishing, entertaining, riveting, nail-biting, funny story told through the medium of the Queen's clothes. It's fantastic. But if I could only save one manga, and again, that's difficult because you can buy... You know, we're so lucky. If our house is burning down, we just go out and buy new stuff with the insurance money. It's hard to get your head around that concept of preciousness anymore, isn't it? But Arnold is out of print, and Arnold was £75, which was like $150 when I bought it, and now I think is considerably more expensive, so I'd save Arnold. But if I could only save one manga, I have a wonderful hardback collected edition of Adolf from Tezuka in Japanese, which was given to me by a dear, dear friend, which I would save for its physical beauty and its sentimental value.
Chiodori also asks, aside from the Anime Encyclopedia, any plans on collaborating again with Jonathan Clements?
Oh, I don't think I could afford him anymore. No, really. I mean, Jonathan nowadays, he still writes and speaks about anime and manga, and he has a wonderful blog, Schoolgirl Milky Crisis, where he writes every week. But and he's speaking, in fact, in a couple of weeks' time at a big symposium with the British writer Andrew Osmond and the film critic Jasper Sharp at a university in East Anglia, which unfortunately I can't get to. But Jonathan writes an awful lot of other books, a lot of different things. He writes on history. He extensively on the history of his adopted homeland, Finland, because he's married to a Finnish girl and has a family over there, but on all kinds of history. So whether we would do another manga book or anime book together, apart from collaborating on any future updates of the encyclopedia that might happen, it'd be really difficult to fit in his schedule. And I'm moving more and more towards different areas within anime and manga than the areas that most interest him. So it really depends. I mean, with any collaboration, it's like dating. You know, the right topic comes up on the right night and you both say, yeah, let's go for this. And you go for it and it's really fun. But it doesn't always turn into marriage, does it?
Indeed. Okay. So last question. This is totally indulgent. Self-indulgent on my part.
Mm-hmm.
Nyalkalis Cage asks, can you sum up Ancast in the form of a haiku?
Oh, give me 2 minutes. Shall we go for 232 and be really daring?
Oh, boy.
Because, it is quite tough to express anything.
I like that's the barometer.
No, can't do 232 because I want the word opinion in there.
Okay. Sure.
Opinion. See, opinion is a really awkward thing. So much depends on pronunciation, but there's no way to do opinion in less than 4 syllables, is there?
I can't get it in 5. I can do it in 5.
Yeah, five is doable. Well,
how many syllables is jackass?
Cast. My opinion is feeble. Just really work, doesn't it?
Excellent.
Did a haiku ending with the word refrigerator on Twitter this morning. I thought that was utterly brilliant. In fact, let me see if I can find it. Pat Cadigan, the great Pat Cadigan, has the best haiku you will read today and probably tomorrow too. Haikus are easy, but sometimes they don't make sense. Refrigerator.
Oh, I saw you retweet that. That was amazing.
Yes, it's beautiful, isn't it? Twitter is such a playground, isn't it? I really adore that. There's a guy called Coyote on there who does, he lives on the edge of the New Mexico desert, and he does some astonishing haiku. He did one this morning, which is not formally strict, but is gorgeous. The sky keeps asking me why your eyes are blue. I mean, that's... You just get these moments of being blown away. But for Ancast, you know, I obviously need more time to think on this one. But what have you got, Zach? Come on.
I have jack shit. I am not a haiku smith. Twitter, you say Twitter is a playground. I use it as my vomitorium. So.
Well, you've been in playgrounds like that. You've never been to school in Liverpool.
There you go.
I actually have one quick question for Helen that I thought Twitter would go on a bit longer than this, so if you'd indulge me.
Yep, absolutely.
Okay, so a couple people know this, but Mike Toole and I nerd out over obscure dubs.
Mm.
And we saw your name associated with a very obscure dub of the first 2 episodes of Catgirl Nuku Nuku.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if you could tell us the story of that, because from what I could tell, that company never released anything else.
No, they didn't. Sadly, they were like a lot of British companies in the early anime boom, very under-resourced and very over-enthusiastic. And they did had wonderful, wonderful dreams that sadly they couldn't fund.
So a bunch of broke fans with, you know, delusions of grandeur.
Essentially. But we happened to be in the studio because, you know, through the magazine, we knew just about everybody in fandom, and we went into the studio to see them recording. And... the vocal director said, we're short of a few people. Would you guys, there are about 3 or 4 of us from the magazine, would you guys do extra voices? So we all read an extra couple of lines here and there. And I did the mother who calls out to her departing child, watch out for bicycles, as Nuku Nuku flies overhead in a bike. It was a lot of fun. I mean, it's always fun hanging around a studio because it's always fun hanging around actors, dear posy creatures that most of them are. And... But no, I mean, you usually have good times in a studio. If the director and the engineer are both thoroughly professional and know what they're doing, they always encourage a good atmosphere in a studio because that way you get a lot of great creative stuff. But nowadays, as I understand it, at anime dubs, most people don't go into the studio in a bunch. Most people just do their own loop in a booth and then the director marries it all together.
That's how it's always been done in the States.
Yeah, which is, you know, you can see the convenience of it, and it means that some people, if they're properly set up at home, can kind of phone something through from home. But there's a dynamic that happens in a performance when everybody's working together, and it may not be efficient. You get a lot of misfires, but you do get some marvelous things happening when that really gels. And so I think it's kind of sad that that's gone. That's an old British radio tradition. We used to have that on early radio. People would do live shows. And I think you do get a kind of energy off a live performance with people bouncing off each other that you don't get when you loop in a booth.
And that's, I mean, that's not still done with the BBC radio dramas?
I believe it is still done with the BBC radio dramas, but not many people do it in the film industry.
Right.
And whenever I get the chance to talk to actors, most of them much prefer working, you know, with other actors, with other people, because that's why they're actors. They want to show things to people. They don't want to stand in a booth with four walls and a microphone. I kind of think it's sad, but it's the way anime's gone, and there are positives to it, in that the fact that it's so much cheaper means that companies can put out more anime, which is great.
Awesome. I always wanted to know what the backstory was on that one, and thank you for enlightening me. I imagine there are several stories like that.
Well, I only have two voice actor credits on my roster, and the other one is Akumako in the British dub of Chaos Century Beast Warriors.
Right, the other one that that Jonathan Clements directed that, didn't he?
That's right, yes. And I think I got that, A, because I threatened to kneecap him if he didn't put me in it, and B, because I have a naturally very high-pitched, squeaky voice, and if you just crank it up a couple of notches more, it becomes quite painful to listen to, which was more or less what he wanted for Akumako.
Oh, boy. Yeah, I've resynchronized KOB Century to DVD. I'll have to send you a copy.
Oh, wow, that would be fun. That'd be fun. And it's sad that a lot of these early dubs and early subs kind of go out of circulation, go out of use. And I have to say, I can see an argument for material that is no longer in copyright and is no longer available being circulated. But it's the no longer in copyright that's the difficult bit for most people, because we don't want to wait.
Well, also, I don't think you can wait in the States anymore. Anything after the 20s just goes on forever.
Mm. Well, corporate copyright, yeah, that's a difficulty. But there's quite a lot of material in Japan, because their copyright law was a bit shorter, that has come out of copyright, and it would be really good to see it circulated. But too many people are interested in ripping off the latest Naruto or whatever to really get onto things like that.
There's some good work being done in the fan community if you dig deep enough.
Oh yeah, yeah, but sadly most people don't dig deep. I mean, the fate of fan historians and fan archivists is to toil away thanklessly for the sake of people who probably come along long after they've gone or stopped working or even died, and say, "Wow, thank God somebody preserved this." But you actually do that kind of thing because you think it's worth preserving.
Yeah, well, story of my life.
Well, it's a good one.
I think we must trade some archives at some point.
Oh, that would be fun if I can ever find anything. I mean, Steve and I are living proof that the TARDIS is a functional reality, because our house is actually too small for all our crap. And if either of us could ever write down the equations, we'd make a fortune.
I have I threw away all my jewel cases, and now I keep everything in a alphabetical file, and it's the best thing I ever did. It's the only way I can ever keep that many discs straight.
Yeah, discs is difficult. We still have videos.
Oh God!
I mean, when we moved, we had 9,500 videotapes.
9,500.
Yeah, not just of anime. You know, quite a lot of stuff. And we've gradually weeded that down and transferred stuff, and obviously you acquire stuff on commercial DVD that you used to tape off the TV because you didn't think it would ever appear again. So we've weeded them down a lot, but we are still working our way through deciding what to transfer and what not to transfer. And we've got a wonderful Japanese VHS to DVD deck that we're using for that, and eventually we will get rid of videotape. But I have a friend up in the north of England who's still running Betamax, and he has an archive of God knows how many thousands of Betamax tapes, and he goes all over the north of England buying up old Betamax machines and cannibalizing them so that he can keep his two betas running. Sooner or later, you know, the crunch is going to come and he won't be able to find any more. And I keep saying to him, for God's sake, start transferring to DVD, start going digital. But, you know, some of us are just devoted to technology, aren't we? Particular old tech.
I still have my LaserDisc player hooked up. I have nothing to say here.
Oh, well, but LaserDiscs are something different, because LaserDiscs are like the old 12-inch vinyl. You get those cool packages.
The packages, and I find that just the weight of it, this very sensual process of loading that into the tray. It's almost like hooking up an old film, 16 millimeter projector. You get that thrill from it.
Oh God, yeah. Yeah, and I mean, I don't know why we ever let the gatefold sleeve go for albums. CDs just do not cut it, and downloads are nowhere, because some of the best geek out experiences of my life have been over grabbing a particular album that I've waited for ages and opening the sleeve, and it's as good as you imagined. It's better than you imagined. You just love this, and then you start, packaging is just fantastic.
I'm afraid that experience is gone.
Yeah, well, not for those who still hang on to Laserdisc. Steve picked up a Godzilla box set in Japan a few years ago, and it's still one of his greatest pleasures. We can't play it. We don't have a Laserdisc player. But he opens the set, and he goes through all the cool stuff that was inside it, and he looks at the packaging, and, you know, it's heaven. It's just great stuff.
The nostalgic waxings of media hoarders.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Well, I suppose I should let you guys go, because it's very nearly 9:30 here, so it's 1:30 with you.
All right, then. Well, it's been an incredible pleasure. We have to do this again soon.
Oh, yeah, that would be great. It's been so much fun. Actually, what might be fun is to get a lot of the or a few of the old school, the really old school fans on, and just riffing together, because I enjoy that so much. We did that a few years back for Anime World Order at an AWA. Rob Fenelon was in the room, and Walter Amos and Dave the Third and Amy, and, you know, just so much fun to kick back and riff. And I don't know if she still does interviews, but I haven't heard Trish Ledoux interviewed in a long time.
Oh, she's checked out of the scene quite willfully and very entirely.
Hmm. And of course she's got that wonderful little boy to look after now. And no, I don't mean Toshi.
Toshi is not little.
Yeah, but Toshi is sweet though. But, yeah, and there's someone else it would be fun to interview, but of course he's got a lot of professional constraints around him.
Yeah.
But it's no, true. That's been the other wonderful thing about the anime scene in the past 20-odd years. There are so many cool people.
Well, at any rate, Zach, you're still around, right?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay. All right, well, why don't we wrap that up then?
Okay, well, Helen, it's been an absolute pleasure. That was so much fun. We're honored to have you on the show. We have wanted to have you on for so long, and it was totally worth it. And we'll have to schedule you again soon to come back on and chat with us.
The pleasure was all mine. Thank you so much. It's been really fun.
Okay, that's our show. Big thanks to Helen McCarthy for stopping by. The theme song is Bucharest. It's by the band The New Division. You can check them out at thenewdivision.net. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes. And while you're there, leave us a little rating or review. We'd appreciate it. And hey, we will see you next week.